Hello and welcome to Father Figures, the show about parenthood with a focus on fathers, uncommon fathers, fathers of all stripes. Here we discuss the joys and griefs, the risks and rewards of being a dad. I'm Stephen Amaya. On today's episode, we meet Adam Orton, who is an Astoria father of three. We talk about faith and disappointment, perseverance and support. I felt more akin to Adam than usual during the interview, mostly because we both share loss, and the subsequent wounds always leave their mark on the psyche. We'll get into this after the interview, because this episode is sort of in two segments. The first about Adam, and the second about me, only because it's time I reintroduce myself along with my credentials, if you haven't had the chance to listen to the first episode. So let's get started. As usual, we began by learning where Adam was from.
So I was born in Eastern Washington, in the Tri-Cities, Richland, more specifically. I have two brothers and two sisters that are all older than me.
Mm-hmm. What was your father like? Was he a disciplinary man or a... Was he distant or present or?
That's, you know, and I think that's a good question. So my father, you know, I think we had a lot of traditional values. Grew up in a Christian household. And he had a lot of the traditional mindset, a lot of integrity, a lot of duty. He would do things that he didn't like to do because he knew it was right for the family. Yeah. And I appreciate that about him. Was he a disciplinarian? He could be. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What did he do for a living?
He was a mechanical engineer.
Oh, okay.
Out at the Hanford site.
Okay. So he kind of glows.
Yeah, I grew up out there, so we all glow a little bit.
You mentioned earlier that you and your wife have gone through several miscarriages. Mm-hmm. How many miscarriages and what was that like?
So I think we had 8 miscarriages. We were in college with our first one. And I think my wife was a senior. And I think I'm a year behind her. We went to BYU, Idaho, member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, sometimes called Mormon. We say the whole name now.
Okay.
But we went to BYU, Idaho, and we just thought after we got married that we'd have a baby right away. And we waited for a little bit, and then we started trying to have a baby, and then Rebecca got pregnant, and we just thought, well, you know, I'll have a baby. It's just how it works. And so when she miscarried the first time, it was devastating.
I bet.
Yeah. And very difficult. And especially in a community that has that expectation to have kids young. And
yeah.
A lot of people get married young. You have kids really early on. And so it was difficult to be in that situation.
Did it change sort of the household mood for a while? Or were you just bouncing back?
That's a good question. You know, especially as it relates to faith, we'd made a decision. Well, I think this forced us to make a decision that you could either look at it one of two ways. You could get angry. We could grow distant. We could, and especially after multiple miscarriages, and you know, the mood could change in a negative way, or we could draw closer together.
Yeah.
And we chose to grow closer together. And really, though, you know, our miscarriages were some of the most difficult times in our lives, those are the times that I felt closest to my wife and closest to God, closer to God even. Yeah. And so it became a profound emotional and spiritual experience for us.
Yeah, it's a life and death stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. Well, when you were a stay-at-home dad, did you choose to be a stay-at-home dad, or were you sort of forced into being a stay-at-home dad?
It sort of happened organically.
Yeah.
So it was during COVID. We decided, so I quit my job and we opened the birth center downtown.
Okay.
So Astoria Birth Center, name drop there. And we decided that's what we wanted to do. And that's something we always wanted to do. And so we got it started. There was a lot of remodeling and certifications and licensing and hiring employees and all that. And I was involved in all that. But when it started coming to day to day, we discovered like somebody has to be at the birth center. Somebody has to be home with the kids. We couldn't afford childcare, nor did we really want to have childcare. Right. And all my kids were at the time, I think everybody was being, you know, remote schooling.
Yeah.
And so, I became the primary, caregiver, I guess. Yeah. And also the teacher.
Yeah, exactly. The teacher. Yeah. That's one thing that was hard to do was the schoolwork with my kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep them focused at home for some reason.
They
feel a lot more comfortable mouthing off to me than they do to their teacher at school now.
what have you sacrificed in your life, or have you? I mean, you seem to have followed a traditional path very well, and it has made you, I think, content and happy, it seems.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I think it depends on how you define traditional, because, you know,
yeah,
I think that traditional household, like my mom stayed at home, my dad went to work, and I honestly feel very lucky that I was able to have my mom at home.
Yeah.
But then I was the stay-at-home parent. Uh-huh. And I kind of am still. Uh-huh. I work from home, and Rebecca still works at the birth center, but my kids go to school and they come home. I can have a flexible schedule so I can be with them. But I think that's not really your question. I've been really happy.
No real big sacrifices that you feel you've made.
Oh.
Nothing you wish you could have done that.
Sacrifice. That was your question. I mean, there's always sacrifices that you have when you have kids.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a musician, and I've played music for a long time, and I think there's probably more I would have done with that had I not had kids. But it's really difficult if I want to go play a show in Atlanta. Like, do I pick up all my kids? And like, can you do that multiple times? I'm going to go on tour, and like, probably not.
Yeah.
And so that's something I kind of put on hold. And, you know, I've worked jobs that I didn't like because I knew I needed to take care of my family.
Right.
Things like that. But ultimately, I knew what it was for.
Uh-huh.
And is for my kids, too.
Now, do you have specific dreams for your kids? Like, one kid you can see doing this, the other kid you can see doing that, and then you sort of have dreams, you know?
Yeah, that's a good question. The first thing that comes to mind is I want my kids to be able to do what they want to do. And that might seem very vague, but I think it's, I don't want them to be limited by, I didn't do very well academically, and I feel like that limited me.
Did you get parental support? Like, oh, you want to do this? Oh, well, let's pursue this.
I think I'm afraid because my parents are going to listen to this. No, I think I was very privileged to live in a household where I had a family that loved me. And my parents, you know, I always wanted to play guitar, and they never stopped me from playing really loud in my room.
Oh, that's
stuff
great.
Like that. Support wise, I always felt whether they did this actively or not, I'm not sure, but it was finish high school, go to college, get a job, get married. Those are the steps you take to mm-hmm. success, and I think in a lot of ways that's correct, but that doesn't mean it's the only way,
right?
I don't want to say that they pushed me towards that, but I think that was kind of the expectation. They did support me in going to school.
That's great.
Things
yeah.
like that. So,
support is a wonderful thing. A lot of people don't get it.
Yeah.
It's amazing how many people don't get it.
Yeah. Well, in the end, they paid for part of my college. And, you know, I think I was really fortunate.
With each of your kids, what are you the most proud of them?
So they're all very different personalities.
Mm-hmm.
My oldest is a girl, Violet, and she's very gregarious. Very outgoing. She'll make friends with anybody as long as they want to be friends with her.
Yeah.
And she doesn't care. She'll talk to anybody. And very happy. She just wants to be happy all the time. She just wants to have fun. She's very smart, likes to read, and she's always creating things. And so that's something I just love about her. They also drive me nuts sometimes, but what I always say is the things that I love most about my kids are also the things that drive me most crazy. Okay. And I think she's a strong-willed, independent girl, and she'll grow up to be a strong-willed, independent woman, which I think will serve her well.
Yeah.
my second is Harvey. He's more reserved. He and I think share more personality traits. He's sensitive and reserved, also very smart, and but he I think he kind of relies on his gregarious sister to build relationships with people. Oh. he wants to make friends, and but he's kind of the person I want to have like a few close friends.
Yeah.
And it's just some great, he has a great attitude.
Yeah.
And often as a peacemaker, he wants to follow the rules, and he's a good example to his
middle
friends.
Child. Middle
yeah, he's the middle child. And I think that's, he kind of fits that persona.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then my youngest is Malcolm, and he's a lot more like Violet. He's very outgoing, gregarious, and very happy.
Yeah.
Too.
Is your wife outgoing and gregarious? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. that's where Violet gets it.
Yeah.
And Malcolm is also very much his own person.
Yeah.
And I think I think it goes with being the youngest, me being the youngest too. Is he knows he can get away with stuff.
Oh, and you can relate being the youngest.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I got away with tons.
Oh, man. So. Can you identify a time in your life when you took the greatest risk? I mean, as a father, you know.
As a father. I mean, yeah, we've actually, Rebecca and I have been risk takers.
Yeah.
In order to follow dreams. It's something I was going to say before, you know. In terms of sacrifices, you know, people talk about not being able to travel or do these things that they want to do when they have kids, and I don't know, we just take our kids with us.
Yeah.
And that's kind of our attitude. And so when we make these risks or take these risks. So one example, we were living in Seattle. We lived there for several years, and I was working at a job that was just killing me.
Yeah.
I hated it. It was a really toxic work environment. It was a smaller company, and they were getting ready to sell too, and so it was just a mess. Rebecca, it was on our anniversary. We looked at each other, and she said, "Look, I can see that you're unhappy. Let's figure something else out." That's when we moved to Astoria. Yeah. Rebecca's from here, and she started working. So she's a doula, and she started working there. And I worked for a small nonprofit in Seaside for a time. But we wanted to get away from kind of the hectic life there.
Yeah.
So that was one thing. We just sort of picked up and moved. And then the other one is starting the birth center, because we put all of our money into it, like everything that we had.
Yeah.
And we've dedicated four and a half years now of our lives to it.
Yeah.
I've only recently started working again.
Yeah.
And so it was scary, but we knew that's what we wanted to do. And especially me, I'm more financially conservative. So when we had to spend a lot of money, like I had to look at it, and I remember the moment saying to myself, like, if I'm on my deathbed and I look back at this, am I going to be grateful that I had all this money in my bank account or that I did something good for our community? And was able to bless other people's lives. I think that it was an obvious choice at that point. We saw a need within our healthcare system, where we have great healthcare services. You know, we have hospitals that are nearby that do a great job at, dispensing interventions for things that are required. I'm kind of trying to use my words carefully here, because birth is the only thing that's not, there's nothing wrong with a person when they have a baby, right? That's
right.
How their body is supposed to work.
Right.
And so it always seemed odd to us that that's something that should happen in a hospital where it's full of sick people, right? Mm-hmm. Not just sick people, you know, people that are hurt or sick. And so, but the other part of that is, you know, I think you kind of get into a mindset when you're in a more traditional healthcare setting of, okay, let's get this person fixed and out the door.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at the birth center, we want to get you, we're not fixing you, we're helping you have your baby, and then we want to allow them time and space to bond with their their baby in with their family unit, whatever that looks like. Mm-hmm. That's really important to us, because that's the beginning of a really important time in your life. And just the number of people who come and not really knowing what to do next. I have this baby. What do I now? What?
Yeah.
And there are resources available, but sometimes you don't know where to look. And so we kind of have that all encapsulated in the birth center, where you could come and you have those resources, and you have people that care about you. Mm-hmm. And we try to have, anyone who comes to the birth center, I don't know if this always happens, but we try to have them visit with every midwife that works there.
Okay.
So when you go and have your baby, you know who you're getting.
Yeah.
And so it's more of a relationship than it is a transaction. And I think especially from a father's point of view, I think in the case of a miscarriage, and I think rightly so, it's a lot of attention. And even when you have a baby, a lot of attention is put on the mother or the person having the miscarriage or baby. And being the partner, the support person in that, and this sounds self-serving, but you don't get any attention.
Right.
Not that I'm sitting, well, I'm here too, pay attention to me. No, like,
right.
But it is like, you're there too, and you're with this person you love,
yeah.
And you want to support them. And what's the best way to do that? But you're also, and this is where I'm getting to loss, is you're also hurting.
Yeah.
And you're also, and you need to allow yourself time to grieve for that too. Don't ignore that, because you're not the person who's having the miscarriage or is physically suffering. This is a loss of a dream. It's a loss of a child that you already love.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important to recognize those feelings and feel them.
Did you name any of the children before they were miscarried?
No, we had a name picked out. Mm-hmm. It was Violet.
Yeah.
And, but I don't think any of our miscarriages were far enough along for us to know the gender of the baby.
Okay.
I think technically we could have found out, but, it was fairly early on.
Okay.
So we had a name picked out, like if it's a girl, it's Violet. And then we miscarry. Yeah. And they were like, had a baby, she's Violet.
Yeah.
So we were ready.
Yeah, that's good. Did you find yourself going through the standard grief cycle of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance? There, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross has that famous death cycle.
Yeah. Yeah,
grief cycle of death.
Grief cycle, yeah.
And, those elements come and go, they come and go at different times and not always in that order,
Yeah. I don't know.
Really?
And I mean, with our first miscarriage, I was pretty young and maybe not as self-aware as I am now, and maybe not as aware of that grief cycle. And also I think at that time, and why I think it's important for, as you're going through loss, any kind of loss, is to allow yourself permission to feel those feelings, at the risk of sounding redundant. But it's important to, because I don't recall, I wanted all the attention to be on Rebecca. And like when we had a baby, it's like, this isn't about me.
Yeah.
It's about Rebecca. I need to just be there for her.
Yeah.
But there is some element that you need to be there for yourself too. Yeah, you have to recognize that, and maybe see a therapist, and maybe, have an opportunity to get those feelings out when the time is right,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think some of those things I suppressed.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I ever got them out. I've seen therapists since, but.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a lot of anger towards God.
Yeah.
Because that was something I felt like.
Yeah.
I did all the right things. Why didn't I get this baby? Like, am I doing something wrong? Mm-hmm. There was a lot of self. And so maybe that's where the grief came in, was self-doubt and anger towards God.
Yeah, yeah.
Since then, I look at it more as gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
Not that the situation was good, but I'm so grateful that it brought my wife and I closer together. Yeah. I'm so grateful that I have kids now. I can look at all the things that I can be grateful for, and that's brought me a lot more happiness.
Yeah.
And I think about that when anything bad happens, effectively, you know.
How about depression? Has that ever visited you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think Rebecca and I have both struggled with that in our lives.
Yeah. So yeah, yeah. Therapy is good.
Therapy, yeah.
So, Adam Orton, thank you for being a guest on Father Figures.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Happy to be here. I look at it more as gratitude. Not that the situation was good, but I'm so grateful.
For me, I can't imagine the anguish and sadness of going through 8 miscarriages. One is enough to send a potential mother and father into a demoralizing spiral. It's clear that Adam's faith has helped carry him along that journey, one that is not taken alone. He spoke of community and family and support. And while some work to overcome loss through religion and faith, others find comfort in biology, science. I don't know if that's a more detached outlook or not. Science reveals wonders that rival anything I can imagine. But sometimes the search for understanding and the why me question grows greater even when there are no scientific answers. There are various ways to find comfort in this grief, not all of them good for you. Jaeger. It's been about 1.5 years since I did any appreciable talking about myself, but I think it's time again. Perhaps you might not have listened to our first exciting episode where I laid out what I consider my credentials. Anyway, you're going to hear a bit from this father and how he came to be where he is. When my daughter was born, she had a stroke. When it was first discovered, a whirlwind began that lasted for weeks, during which doctors and nurses saved her life many times. As a result, she has cerebral palsy and epilepsy. And because my wife had the better career, I stayed home full-time to take care of her. I did that for 25 years solid. I was lucky to be able to do that. Lucky, of course, is a flexible word. All fathers are unique, but there are internal changes that occur when your child is born with a disability. At least in me there were. The saying goes something like, we bought tickets to London and ended up in Minsk. I became less verbal, much more isolated. To quote Kurt Vonnegut, it was, quote, like pouring honey into a fine Swiss watch. At the time, it was much more rare to encounter a stay-at-home dad in the wild, let alone one with a disabled child. Consequently, for years, I lived in a world full of mommies with typical children, ones who didn't have CP and seizures. And there was a good deal of sexism among the suburban moms, and this surprised me. Also, I've been pursued by media, print, and television because of this, and served on panels with other fathers who've experienced this situation. So I've been in the daddy world for a while. Maybe that's why I do the show. I might still be in mourning for the death of the dreams, like the dreams most expectant fathers carry about their baby that's due, like romancing a diamond before it's cut. There is a longing, one that makes me tear up in the checkout line when in front of me I see a child in her mother's arms, and that child can use its right hand. It's the little things. Also, in a few fathers, myself included, and I don't know why, there can be a sense that we've been chosen, somehow picked by some powers that be to undertake the Sisyphean task of raising a child, particularly a non-typical one. It seems an odd notion to some. To others, it may be the center of their faith. I found my greatest challenges to be overwhelming sadness and a slow-burning anger. But if you're an atheist, with whom can you be angry? Love can become a very active verb then, and shows itself not only as a feeling, but more importantly, as a skill. I remember wanting to see my kid the way Adam sees his, with bright, bright futures. But it didn't work out that way. I remember something Adam said about the miscarriages. It was, quote, the loss of a dream, the loss of a child that you already love, unquote. When my daughter's stroke happened, it was a loss, and something changed in me. For the first year, nothing was funny. I didn't laugh. There was an odd exhilaration mixed with deep sadness that's tempered only by the balm of time. Her stroke is the pebble in my shoe. There's something that Adam noticed happens after a miscarriage. One becomes aware of the expectations of one's community. The same is true when a disabled child is born and grows up. Silence turns to whispers. I want to advocate, and this is important to me, I want to advocate for awareness that tragedy can strike anyone at any time through stroke or accident or whatever. Disability is a game anyone can play. So anyway, I thank you for indulging me. You help by listening, and I try to make the guests interesting, present company excluded. But enough about me. I want to thank Adam Orton for being a guest on the show. And I want to thank Jason Shaw of Audionautics.com for the music. And if you'd like to get in touch with me, drop a line to RadioRanchero@gmail.com. Now, I suppose I should make a tradition on this show of presenting a dad joke. I've had some suggestions that I keep the feature. It started recently, and it looks like it's going to take, mostly due to popular demand, you see, and who doesn't love a dad joke? Actually, this one is a dad riddle, so here goes. Who's bigger, Mr. Bigger or Mr. Bigger's baby? It's Mr. Bigger's baby, because he's a little bigger. I knew you'd like it. If you'd like to send a complaint about that joke or just comment in general, remember, shoot me an email at RadioRanchero@gmail.com. That's it for now. And remember, the days may be long, but the years are short. I figure I should let you know how my daughter is doing. Well, she's 33 now, has 2 AA degrees, drives her own modified vehicle, has conquered epilepsy with the help of good medication, and lives independently. Yes, I'm proud.
I look at it more as gratitude. Not that the situation was good, but I'm so grateful.
You are listening to KMUN Astoria and KTCB Tillamook.